From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Bill Hader, who won an Emmy last night for Barry, on the experiences that he shares with his character in the show.
I remember that time of you move out to L.A. and this might not work, but you find a community of people who are all in the same boat you are, and those are friendships I still have.
Then comedian Hannah Gadsby hopes her difficult story of growing up gay can bridge divides.
The human condition is what we all share, but in order to really appeal to the humanity of those you don't share experience with, you need to tell it through a story.
All that coming right up.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
This year's Emmy Awards said a lot about where television is headed, even if the ceremony itself revealed how it's stuck in the past. HBO and Netflix tied for the most overall trophies. Some Emmys went to older shows like HBO's Game of Thrones and NBC's Saturday Night Live, but SNL was an exception, with broadcast networks being largely shut out. And perhaps it wasn't a surprise that the ratings for the ceremony on NBC hit an all-time low. Meanwhile, one big hit of the night with 5 wins was the Amazon comedy The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, a show that may have been entirely new or unknown to many viewers. And that makes the Emmy telecast less like the Super Bowl of TV than what it might have once been.
It is about discovery at this point, and I think that is a role that perhaps the Emmys is moving into rather than being the Super Bowl of, you know, television.
LA Times TV critic Lorraine Ollie and I discussed our big takeaways from the night.
Broadcast networks really were kind of like the losers last night. And if you look at, you know, the 25 or so awards that were given out, really only 2 of them, I think, went to, you know, your traditional broadcast networks. And it really seemed like it was a night. The big winner last night was really streaming services. So Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. The other thing, though, was that the Emmys seemed just as overwhelmed with the amount of programming and the amount of shows that are out there as we all are. You could just kind of see it in, you know, the kind of narratives they were trying to push. This show's going to be about diversity. No, wait a minute. It's going to be about, you know, fill in the blank. And it's like, no, you just couldn't pick one narrative. It was kind of fragmented in the same way that the industry is right now.
When you think about what the Academy said at the top of the show and then what it did in terms of handing out awards, I think there was a huge disconnect. They started by talking about diversity.
We're also celebrating the fact that this year's Emmy Awards has the most diverse group of nominees in Emmy history. Yes, indeedy. One step closer to a black Sheldon. That's right. I'm gonna go ahead and say it. We solved it.
Wait, seriously? Wait, so diversity is not a problem in Hollywood anymore?
Nope, we solved it.
Wow.
And then you start looking at the awards. The first 10 awards and 22 out of 26 overall in the primetime ceremony went to white performers, directors, writers, and producers. You start thinking about the people who won: Matthew Rhys, Bill Hader, Henry Winkler, Alex Borstein, Darren Criss, Merritt Weaver, Jeff Daniels, Lorne Michaels, John Oliver. What happens is they talk a lot about the game they're going to play at the beginning of the show. And then once they start playing, it's a really different game. The trophies they hand out go to white people. And then I want to get back to what you said, Lorraine, too, about broadcast networks. Lorne Michaels tried to make a defense for network TV in his acceptance speech for Saturday Night Live.
In 1975, when we started, there were a lot of articles for most of that decade about how the networks wouldn't be here much longer. And here we are. It's 2018, and we're the Emmys, and we're on NBC. Thanks.
NBC won 16 total Emmys, counting all awards, not just the primetime show. And then you drop all the way down to Fox with 3 and CBS with 2. And that means if you really look closely, the networks had fewer trophies combined than a lot of the like cable channels. Like CNN had 8 Emmys. And Lorraine, I think that is kind of indicative of not just where the quality of the programming is, but also that you know, Emmy voters don't seem to be that interested in broadcast shows at all.
No, no, they don't. I mean, poor Lorne Michaels, that was so defensive. I almost felt bad for him last night. But I don't think the Emmy voters, and I think the Emmy voters and also critics and also people who are kind of, you know, looking at the cultural direction of television right now, broadcast networks don't really kind of fit into the picture of what's innovative, of what's pushing things forward. Yes, some of their shows are still the most watched and top rated, but I wouldn't say that they're, you know, indicative of kind of what's going on in the culture right now. But I mean, I just wanted to get back to one thing about, you know, the idea of this going to be a year at the Emmys of diversity and how they had kicked off the show with that skit about, look, we solved it. We solved this problem of, you know, Emmys too white or TV too white. In comedy, the marvelous Miss Maisel won several times in top categories over Atlanta, over Black-ish. And that was really, really surprising, given, you know, just especially with Atlanta, what a breakthrough show that is and how topical it is and how it twists that genre so much. You can't even tell if it's a comedy or not. It's such a wonderful show where I would argue Maisel, yeah, not so much.
I think in some ways this kind of brings up the whole, what are the Emmys supposed to recognize? Are they supposed to recognize a show like Atlanta or Black-ish that are really innovative, that are telling stories in different ways? You look at The Marvelous Miss Maisel, you could say slightly innovative, but if you take out the language, you take out some of the nudity, is it really breaking the mold in any other way? And I would say that's really true of Game of Thrones, which won the drama trophy. It is obviously epic. There's a lot of production value, like great scale. But you look at Handmaid's Tale, especially in its second season, about what it's saying about the world we live in, about the way that it's marrying current politics with this dystopian future. I think it's a much more innovative show in terms of storytelling. I think that's what the Academy is really trying to wrestle with. Are they recognizing accomplishment or innovation? Because sometimes they're not one and the same.
I think it just means that they're so much out there, and also several different platforms. There's just so much programming out there that things get lost in the shuffle, number one. And number two, you know, these shows that are winning, these shows that are getting attention, like Maisel, like even Handmaid's Tale, which is a great show, don't necessarily have a huge audience. These are like fairly niche audiences when you look at the kind of audiences and viewership that television used to have even 15 years ago. So I think it's just the idea that so much gets lost in this avalanche of good, mediocre, and yes, some bad programming.
That was Lorraine Ollie, TV critic for the LA Times. Coming up, Bill Hader didn't come to LA to be an actor, but Hollywood made him one anyway. Saturday Night Live alumnus Bill Hader took home an Emmy last night for lead actor in a comedy series. But if you rewind 20 years ago, he certainly wouldn't have predicted that it might happen. Hader came to Los Angeles in hopes of pursuing a career as a director, and he only inadvertently got into acting instead. In Barry, he gets to do a bit of both. He co-created the show with Alec Berg, a writer and executive producer on another HBO series, Silicon Valley. Hader also directed the first three episodes of Barry. In the series, he plays a professional hitman. Here, his character is talking with prospective clients.
Now, there's a lot of ways I can do this for you. One of them is I could stab him in the nut. That's something I did once, and I'm very comfortable doing it again.
What?
Or not.
Why?
Forget about it.
Who would want this?
But when Hader's trained killer gets to L.A. to do the hit, he stumbles into an acting class, and it changes his life. It's led by a very methody teacher, played by Henry Winkler, who also won an Emmy last night. When Bill Hader came by the Frame studio earlier this year, we started with his earliest aspirations in Hollywood.
You know, I moved out to L.A. in 1999, and I was, you know, looking in the back of Hollywood Reporter, and I remember seeing Aaron Brockovich, new Steven Soderbergh movie being shot. Oh, gosh, I'd love to work on that, you know, and calling the production office, do you guys need a PA? And they said, fax us a resume. And I went, well, I haven't really done anything. And so you end up working on really, really low budget movies. I worked on a movie called Final Payback with Richard Grieco and John Saxon and Marty Cove. You know, straight to video kind of action movies. But you learned on that. And then I got in with a group of ADs. I worked with a guy named Jerry Grandy and a guy named Daryl Woodard. And we did Collateral Damage, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
And is there a moment, I don't know if it's Collateral Damage, where a bit actor doesn't show up and you get a speaking part? You get in the guild
yeah.
that way?
What well, what happened was, it? Was, it was, yeah, it was Collateral Damage, and they just said, we need a pilot. And Bill, you fit the pilot outfit. So, Bill, you're going to be in the pilot. And so I was just an extra. And then Andrew Davis, the director, said, Arnold, why don't we just start? They're rehearsing the scene. And he's, Arnold, why don't you ask? Or no, it was Elias Koteas, the actor. He said, Elias, why don't you ask the pilot, you know, how long we got? And pilot, you know, just say 3 or 4 hours, depending on the weather.
How much time we got?
3 or 4 hours, depending on the weather.
And I could hear Jerry Grandy go, that's Bill. And, oh, wait, we got Bill up there? Oh, yeah, Bill, just say 3 or 4 hours, depending on the weather. And I was next to a guy who was an actual extra, and he's looking at me like, you son of a b-. And so, yeah, I got into SAG. That's how I got into
SAG. You got your SAG card.
That's how I got into SAG, was that they did that. And it didn't end up in the movie. It's on the deleted scene. So,
oh, yeah. But you still got your card.
Yeah.
The character you play in Barry is a guy who is very good at a job that he doesn't like, and not so good at a job that he wants, which is not unique to Hollywood, but the thing that he is not so good at is acting. The thing that he is good at is killing people. Mm-hmm. How do you come up with that dichotomy?
You know, being a hitman, you have to live in the shadows. The whole thing is that you're anonymous. And then the acting world is wanting to be in the spotlight and being known, you know? And then what we liked about it was that the stakes of that was life. If he is good at his job at acting, he's risking his life. And that's always good when the stakes are that high for something so stupid. But then the reason he's doing it is an emotional thing of trying to, on some level, atone for all the bad things that he's done. And try to understand how to be a human, how to elicit some sort of emotion. And the irony that we thought was that all these acting students are in there drawing on all these kind of really awful things that they've done. But if Barry did that, it would unlock some terrible, crazy stuff that then could implicate them. And now their lives are at stake. And so it just, the more we talked about it, we were like, oh gosh, there's a lot of stakes here that we thought, and it was a weird situation, but it was emotional.
I suspect you didn't spend a lot of time with real hitmen researching how they go about their jobs, but it does feel that you spent a lot of time in this community trying to figure out not just how the classes are structured, but the kind of person who is drawn to acting, and in your show, maybe don't have the greatest chops, but really believe in this dream or this idea of becoming an actor.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that we were talking earlier about me being in a PA. It's like, I remember that time of you move out to LA and this might not work, but you find a community of people who are all in the same boat you are. And those are friendships I still have, you know, because you were all freaked out together and struggling together. And what's great about the acting class is that, you know, you have like consultants, you know, like we had like a military consultant on the show.
Because your character is ex-Marine Corps.
He's ex-Marine. The whole acting class were consultants on the acting class. Like all those actors had been through this. So it was really great to just ask Darcy Carden or, you know, Ryder Doyle, whoever, any of these actors and be like, well, is this what would happened? Do you know an exercise like this, the exercise you have to do? And they go, I know yes, the Meisner technique, I know exactly what that is, you know, and they would throw out jokes and things that Alec and I wouldn't know necessarily.
Did you find yourselves intentionally thinking that you were making a show in many ways about camaraderie, that your character is somebody who's been in the military and has his circle of friends through that, and that these students in this acting class are not just friends in the class, they're friends outside of the class, that there is community. It's set in L.A., everybody's scattered, but they come together and they have some sort of special bond like your character does in the military through acting.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, absolutely. And I think that was a thing. There was one Marine that I talked to, and he said the best thing about being in the Marines is you have a community. And a lot of these guys, when they get out, they lose a community and they lose their identity. You know, when they're in the Marines, they are a private, a sergeant, a lieutenant. You know, they have this. And then they get out and they're just Mike, you know?
So when you're thinking about directing, and we end up directing on Barry, do you remember the directors that you worked alongside? And do you try to emulate their best behavior or avoid their worst behavior?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the best directions as an actor are like, I do like faster, slower.
Stand there. Move this way.
Could you move this way and just a little faster? But when people come up and go, I think what he's going through is the man is, you know, my eyes glaze over and just say, what do you want? Or active things. That's helpful. Greg Mottola, when we were doing Superbad, there was a scene where I'm supposed to yell at McLovin. He's in bed with this girl and he's run out on me and I'm mad at him and I'm screaming at him. And I was doing it really broad, like, oh, this is what'll be funny. And it wasn't working. And Greg came over, and the only thing he said was, hey, man, that's your best friend. And that's all I need. That was right. It. And he goes, that's your best friend. And so in the next take, it was like, hey, man, why'd you do that? And everyone started laughing because it was real, you know?
You directed how many episodes?
Three.
The fourth episode is directed by a woman, and I think it's also written by a woman.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of women running departments or in prominent positions on the show. Was that intentional? And if so, why did you go that way?
You know, I mean, it wasn't like a thing of, oh God, we need to get like women in, you know, on the show. It really was. I looked at a bunch of reels and they showed me a bunch of comedy DPs, director of photography. They showed me a bunch of comedy people. And then suddenly I saw this amazing footage from these dramas. And I went, oh, who's that? Like, oh, her name's Paola Widobro. She's from Mexico City. She's worked with Terrence Malick. She works with Manuel Lubezki. And I'm like, oh, that's who we need on the show, you know? And then she comes in and knocks it out of the park. Maggie Carey directed that fourth episode, and Sarah Solmani wrote it. We also had Emily Heller and Liz Sarnoff. All these people were people that I met, and they just got it. And I've been in the room, I've been in the comedy room where it is a bunch of white guys, and it you kind of create the same thing every time, you know what I mean? And when you have other, you know, whether it's women or any diversity, as they say, you know, in the room, it just makes things better. It just has, I've learned that at SNL.
You start as a PA kind of thinking that maybe that's going to lead you to directing. It actually leads you to acting when you get this small part in Collateral Damage. Having directed now, does it change your priorities of what you want to do going forward and how you see your own career unfolding?
That was the thing I always wanted to do, was direct. I mean, I was moving out to LA. I wanted to write and direct. And acting was never a thing on my radar. And then I started taking classes at Second City LA because I just needed to do something creative. You do that. You come out here and then you're like, wow, I came out here to be creative and I haven't done a single creative thing because I got to pay the bills. I took those classes out of frustration, really, just to do something. And then it led to me getting Saturday Night Live, which was never a thing that I thought of. So the fact that it's taken this weird, circuitous way of getting to the thing that I wanted to do in the first place is great. So getting a chance to direct and learning, too. I mean, Maggie Carey, Hiro Murai, and Alec Berg directed the other episodes of Barry. And I learned so much from them as well, you know, watching those directors work. And, yeah, getting more to do that would be awesome.
Bill Hader is the co-creator, director, and actor in Barry. Bill, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Barry is available on HBO and HBO Go. Coming up, an Australian comedian who shares a lot of personal heartache between her jokes.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows nine high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Australian comedian Hannah Gadsby is used to performing on the fringe, but at last night's Emmy ceremony, where she was a presenter, she was front and center.
That's a joke, of course. Just jokes, fellas. Calm down. It's, you know, hashtag not all men, but a lot of them. It is just jokes, but what are jokes these days? We don't know. Nobody knows what jokes are, especially not men. am I right, fellas?
Most Emmy viewers probably didn't know who Gadsby is, but her wry comedic style is what made her recent Netflix special one of the funniest and most powerful shows in recent memory. Gadsby, who's gay, grew up on the island of Tasmania, where she says that most residents believe that gay people are subhuman. She internalized that homophobia, suffered violent trauma, and then, once she began doing comedy, made it part of her routine. When we spoke this past June, just before the premiere of her Netflix special titled Nanette, Gadsby said she wanted to change her approach to comedy.
My whole story was always told around a joke, diffusing it, but also laughing at homophobia, not acknowledging that it existed within me. Throughout my comedy career, I went from telling this story and sealing off, you know, this trauma into acceptable jokes. And I began to really, really wobble in the last few years during the gay marriage debate because I was aware that there was still, you know, this deep wound of shame that has never been talked about. You know, I often say that perhaps there should be a black stripe on the gay pride flag to acknowledge publicly that trauma that so many of us live through. You don't just come out and instantly undo shame. You need the entire community that helped place that inside of you to also help undo that.
Somebody who I think knew the trauma that was to come and the toxicity of homophobia and how it affects people is your mom. There's a passage in the show where you talk about your mom, and I want to play a little bit from that scene.
But what my mum eventually said to me is pretty much at the core of why I'm questioning comedy. She said to me, "The thing I regret is that I raised you as if you were straight. I didn't know any different. I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. I knew well before you did that your life was going to be so hard. I knew that, and I wanted more than anything in the world not to be the case. But I now know I made it worse. I made it worse because I wanted you to change, because I knew the world wouldn't." And I looked at my mum in that moment and I thought, how did that happen? How did my mum get to be the hero of my story?
Sorry, that's strong. I haven't watched my own special, listened to myself. So that's kind of that's thrown me a little bit. And my mum was in the audience that night.
Oh my goodness!
It made it such a difficult filming. What was incredible about that apology that mum gave me is that it wasn't one that I asked for. It wasn't one that I knew I needed. You know, I thought, well, fine, we've dealt with it. And I think it's an incredible story that as a family we moved through from being basically ignorant and homophobic, all of us, to, you know, being completely not. And that was enough for me. And then she came through with that apology, which said to me, she still interrogated that story. And I just don't think we hear apologies like that in our world, where there's no reservation, no defensiveness, no excuses, taking full responsibility. And also, you know, to offer that apology without being asked. And for my mind, yes, that does make my mum the hero of this story. And it did force me to really question the way that I've told my story, which was to turn trauma into a joke.
Part of my problem is comedy has suspended me in a perpetual state of adolescence. The way I've been telling that story is through jokes. And stories, unlike jokes, need three parts, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Jokes, only two parts, a beginning and a middle.
You know, something that you really touch on in your show is that it's impossible for a male attorney to know what it feels like to be a female lawyer in a room filled with men. It's impossible for a white motorist to know what it's like to be driving while black and stopped by the police. And as we're dealing with everything that's going on in the world, how do people like me, I'm a straight white male, how do we change our perspective so that we understand others better?
It's just through story. Facts, we've seen this. One of the big things that I think I observed with the fake news phenomenon is that, you know, the facts don't actually matter. What fake news was and still is something that's sort of appealing to an already told story. And that story is the victim of, you know, Middle America being a victim. And then the conspiracy theories of why, you know, this struggle there being pinned onto minorities. And so that's when I started to really invest in the idea of story, because stories can be told constructively in a way that appeals to humanity of an individual and going, hey, I'm a human, and to touch on the human condition from a different perspective. You know, so it's like the human condition is what we all share, but in order to really appeal to the humanity of those you don't share experience with, you need to tell it through a story, because it really is the only way that you stop people fearing your difference, is to make yourself look just as human as they are. And our leaders are not invested in that as an idea. So I believe it's up to cultural leaders and anyone with a public voice to really demand space for minorities to take up space in the world and to, you know, have their own voice and tell their own story.
Hannah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
You can find Annette on Netflix. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.